Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, a conversation with the CEO of the Phoenix Art Museum on the museum's role in the city and recent criticism. We'll also talk about how mourning has changed in the digital age.
But first this hour, Phoenix police are mourning the loss of one of their officers today. Officer Paul Rutherford was investigating a traffic accident yesterday when he was hit by a motorist crossing Indian School Road. He later died in the hospital. Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams joins us now for a few minutes. Chief Williams, thank you for being here. Sorry it has to be under these circumstances.
Hey, Mark and Steve, thanks so much for having us here.
So can you tell us a little bit about Officer Rutherford?
When I think of Paul, I think of someone who's hardworking, respected by his supervisor, always had a smile, extremely reliable. And moments before his death, he is consoling a young girl who had a car accident, telling her, hugging her, making sure she knows that it was going to be okay. And in a split second, makes a conscious choice to have to go across the street because there's a priority one call of a person with a fight and his partner is already over there. So true hero would be the ultimate word for him.
I think for a lot of people, when they think about the dangers that police officers face, they think about, you know, maybe this is because of TV or movies. They think of, unfortunately, officers sometimes are shot, sometimes they're hurt or killed in other ways. But how common or uncommon is it that something like this might happen to a police officer? They're hit by a car.
Well, they're hit. So if you think of the line of duty deaths across the country, half of those happen in some type of traffic accident and or in a vehicle. So it's not uncommon for the law enforcement community. It just may not necessarily be something that we want to talk about here. But just remember, we're the second law enforcement agency to have an officer who is killed as a result of an accident.
Chief, education is so important, and I don't want to, obviously we're not going to leave Officer Rutherford, but I'm curious when it comes down to the things that you would want the public to think about. Are there things that when it comes down to actually paying more attention when the flashing lights are on or when an officer is clearly helping someone out, are there things the public can do to help in this kind of situation?
I think we can all help by when you see emergency vehicles, be it police, fire, paramedics, you name it, just slow down and take a little bit more time and more caution because you really don't know what's going on in the scene that the officers and paramedics and firefighters are working. We want folks to just take a little bit of time and to slow down just a little bit more.
Is that something that you see as a general problem around the city? Is that something, distracted driving is an issue for folks in many ways. Would you like to see more attention paid to that?
So when we think about the distracted driving, we know that Officer Clayton Townsend from Salt River was struck by a distracted driver. So when we're driving, you got to pay attention. So roll down the windows, pay attention. Definitely don't text and drive. And then talking on the phone and driving where your attention is diverted is always going to be something that we want to make sure our public pays attention to.
Chief Williams, are there funeral arrangements? Do we know that there are, for the public who might want to show their respects or anything like that, have those arrangements been made at this point?
So thank you, Mark and Steve, for asking that. No, the arrangements haven't been made. It's been just a little bit over 24 hours. His family is obviously in shock. His squad is in shock. So as soon as we get those details, we'll make sure that the public knows. We truly appreciate the support that we've gotten from local media. We appreciate the support that we've gotten from the public. So if people want to donate to Officer Rutherford's family, we have phoenixpolicefoundation.org. It's actually phxpolicefoundation.org. But when you see a police officer out on the street, we're asking that you all just take a couple seconds and tell them thank you for their service, because day in and day out, even in spite of tragedies like this, we had the most horrific day on our department yesterday, yet the men and women are still putting the uniform on, answering calls for service today.
Well, Chief, let me close off of that then. So how is your department generally doing, and how do you as chief, as leader of that department, help focus? Though we know that they're out there doing their jobs, how do you help bring them together after something like this?
So great question. Actually, we rally together. We make sure that they have the psychological services and mental services and spiritual services that they need. But at the end of the day, it's providing a hug, a good word, just a constant reminder to take care of each other and take care of the community that we serve. So it was very somber in the station yesterday. I was there earlier today, but weren't very many people there. But just a somber lull. But we also know, too, that Officer Rutherford died serving his community. He died doing what he chose to do. He made the conscious choice to be a patrol officer, someone who's answering calls for service every single day for almost 23 years. So he's a true hero in my eyes.
All right. That's Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams. Chief Williams, thanks a lot for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, you all. Have a good day.
Amada Cruz moved to the Valley 4 years ago from San Antonio to take over as CEO of the Phoenix Art Museum. Her tenure has included expanding the museum's diversity outreach and an increased focus on creating exhibitions that the museum could essentially rent to other facilities around the country. Recently on the show, we spoke with writer Robert Pala about his Phoenix New Times piece that contained considerable criticism of Cruz and how she was managing the museum, including the venerable Docent Volunteer Program. Earlier, I spoke with Cruz about aspects of that article. I started, though, by asking what her mission was when she first stepped into the CEO role.
Well, I was actually tasked to actually think about the museum in terms of where we are now in 2019. What has the city actually become? As you know, Phoenix is actually, surprisingly to many people, a young city, very diverse. And in my interview, what I really talked about was reaching out to audiences. So I was actually hired with a mission to broaden the base of support for the museum, but not just in terms of fundraising, which of course goes without saying, but also in terms of really thinking about what is the community in Phoenix and the Greater Valley right now. And my task was really to make it relevant for 2019 and certainly for beyond that.
So how challenging is that, and what are some of the specific challenges behind that?
Well, it's an interesting process because you really need to start by thinking about and looking at what the city has become and getting to know a city very quickly, especially from someone for someone like me who came from out of town. I had to sort of learn very, very quickly what I was dealing with. The challenges are trying to sort of balance a couple of things, being as accessible as possible, which is really my priority. I very, very much want the museum to belong to everybody in the Valley. I do not want it to belong to a select few or particular demographics, let's say. That's really not my intention. And so how do you balance making sure that you do not lose the folks that have been in the museum membership for a very long time, but also how do you actually broaden that support and broaden that audience for the museum? And that's been incredibly exciting, and I think especially for the staff, we just love it when the museum is full of people, when it's full of energy, when they're young kids. I always like to say that I want the museum to be loud because that means that they're really engaging in the art and in everything that we do. And that, to me, is my big priority and also my mission.
When it comes down to that, are there things that have worked really well so far and things that are still in progress?
Well, we know that younger generations really like experiences, and that's what really we provide at the museum now. So, for example, First Fridays have become such a big, wonderful celebration for us about the artwork on display, and what we usually do is have a First Friday theme. So, for example, the recent Teotihuacan show, which was an extraordinary show of archaeological material from Mexico, we had a First Friday where we really had a lot of sort of Mexican themes going on. We had 5,000 people come to the museum that night, many of whom had come for the very first time. And so I think as you provide experiences, but also, again, relevance, make it as relevant as possible to the audience that exists today, because I can't really do a whole lot about what the museum was in 1959, but I certainly have a sense for what it is right now.
When it comes to big exhibitions, and then it comes to sort of the day-to-day operations and having the school groups and more kids and that sort of thing, what's the balance there when you're expanding? Because like anything, you need money, but you also want to give more people the opportunity. Is that a balancing act too?
It's always a balancing act. It all is, absolutely. So, you know, again, one of my biggest priorities is accessibility. And so what we tried to do was really raise as much money as we possibly can to provide free days. So we have a lot more free access hours now so that families really can come to the museum. Money is definitely not a barrier for enjoying the museum. We do think specifically in terms of exhibitions, we balance that. In any given year, there are popular exhibitions like Teotihuacan. We pretty much knew that would be a popular exhibition. It actually exceeded our expectations. We had 72,000 people coming through the doors, and it made money for the museum. There are other exhibitions. For example, we have a beautiful show up now of the work of a painter, Agnes Pelton. It's a bit more academic, perhaps a bit more refined, but it's such a beautiful show, and it has something to do with our collection, because the works were actually, the show was inspired by our collection. So it also has this local importance, which I think is something to celebrate. And that is actually turning into a little bit of a sleeper hit. So even though we may not have anticipated the kind of numbers that we got for Teotihuacan, I think Agnes Pelton is going to do quite well for us. And it's also an exhibition that we knew would be interesting to other museums around the country. So another priority for me was actually expanding what we did in terms of exhibitions and actually exporting the scholarship of the museum. So that exhibition is traveling to four other museums around the country, including the Whitney Museum of American Art, which is a first for the Phoenix Art Museum. We are extraordinarily proud of the fact that our exhibition is going to the premier American art museum in the country.
Should the Phoenix Art Museum be a leader in this community? Should you be focused on doing the best you can? And accessibility, you mentioned. Is this something where a particular entity is supposed to be one that sort of leads the pack? How do you view that?
If you're asking locally, I certainly do think that we need to be a leader in the community. I think we lead by example, right? So I'm actually on a lot of panels, and I speak publicly all the time, and I'm always pushing for this idea of accessibility and also for diversity. Diversity is a huge priority for the museum. In terms of nationally, I think we can be leaders. I think we actually should strive and have large ambitions to be known for a lot of the programming that we're doing. I just got back from New York, and ironically, sort of nationally, we're really known for all this Latino outreach. We are going to be premiering a new website in the spring, and it's going to be the first major museum website that's going to be fully bilingual. I think that's something that we're very proud of and to be celebrated. Our bilingual programs in general are now being known across the country, and we're even getting grants for them from national foundations. So you really try to balance the local and the global. And I think, you know, again, everything that we do is a bit of a balancing act, but we're pretty proud of the place we are right now.
Were you surprised that anyone publicly would come out and criticize the museum and you?
I am a sort of semi-public figure in this town, so I figure it's actually okay that the arrivals come to me. I certainly take them for the staff, let's just say. I was surprised by the level of vitriol.
Do you have the impression going forward that people are concerned that some changes are being made they don't like, or that there are some things that you could improve?
Well, there's always room for improvement, of course, right? Everybody should have the modesty and the humbleness to sort of, you know, realize that. But I do think this is the way that I describe it. There is a huge network of people that started the museum. This was actually a volunteer-generated museum, and they are still around. And the way that I describe it is that every little change that I make is a revolution for a certain percentage of our audience. And we try to manage that change, and I certainly try to be as gentle as possible. I firmly believe that if you explain things logically to people about why you're doing certain things, that they will come along, or they will give you feedback that you can then respond to. But sometimes people are just resistant to change, and I knew coming into this that there would be some of that.
How important is the docent program to what you do?
Extremely important. The docents, as they know, I call them the ambassadors for the museum. They're very often the first people that visitors interact with when they come to the museum. We have an incredibly robust docent program. We have over 300 docents. That's actually three times the number of the Art Institute of Chicago, which is 10 times our size. So we do have a robust program, and we've made some changes so that, again, the museum and the docents are actually responding to the local situation that it is in 2019. And that means that our museum is all about public service. We serve our public. In the last year, even though we lost some docents, we've actually increased our school tours by 24%. So these changes, which again were generated by the docents who are in leadership positions of the docent program, have actually been incredibly productive for our audiences, and they have a lot to be proud of.
Has there been a change in the education program, as was posited in this article, to the point where the docents who are giving more tours maybe know less?
It's actually not about them knowing less. I think that's actually a mischaracterization. It's really the way that they impart information. And this actually is a change that I didn't start. It actually started 10 years ago before I got there. And this really mirrors what other docent programs around the country have done, which is instead of having someone lecturing to you, which, let's face it, most people don't want to be lectured to, it's much more of a dialogue between the docent and the audience member. I know when I give tours, and I actually love to do that, I'm pretty much reading the group, who's in there, how old are they, and then you kind of respond and go back and forth, because I think all of us learn better when we engage rather than passively receive information. So yes, the style of delivery has changed, but the actual knowledge has not changed. Now, the one thing I can say is when we have a particular exhibition, like Teotihuacan, of course, that year the curriculum will change because the docents have to be able to speak about that work. And frankly, so do I. So we're all learning together.
Amada Cruz, CEO of the Phoenix Art Museum. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
This election season, we're going to see changes that impact candidate fundraising. Some are official, like rules for Democrats set by the Democratic National Committee, or DNC, and some that are unofficial. Amy Walter, with our partner The Takeaway, explains.
I'm not taking a dime of PAC money in this campaign. I'm not taking a single check from a federal lobbyist.
That, of course, is Senator Elizabeth Warren. And she's not alone. Pretty much every major Democratic candidate has said they will refuse corporate PAC money. Maggie Severns, a reporter who covers money in politics, said there does seem to be a new set of rules for financing campaigns this time around.
You know, I would say that there are some new rules, and they're kind of rooted in the previous presidential election, where we saw some really interesting things going on. You know, most notably, we saw Trump really running on this kind of idea of draining the swamp, you know, and I think that one thing we learned from the last election is that voters are really concerned about corruption and they're really concerned about money. And so one thing that you're seeing this cycle is a lot of Democrats, as they enter the field, they're putting all these rules on how they raise money. And they're doing this to really make a statement saying, you know, I'm not the candidate of the rich.
It wasn't just Donald Trump who ran on the his message was basically, you can't buy me off because I've
rich.
Got my own money, right?
Yeah.
So nobody, I don't have special interests. And he also sort of exposed the game, right? Mm-hmm. I was one of those donors. I get it. You give money to get access. So he was sort of the truth teller. And the other truth teller was Bernie Sanders, who also ran on this, my average contribution is $27. Now we go to 2018. So many Democrats swore off corporate funding.
Yeah, there were
for
dozens
their campaigns.
Of them.
And I remember talking to a lot of worried Democratic strategists who said they're never going to be able to raise enough money. They were proven wrong. A lot of these first-time candidates raised $5, $6, $7 million through small-dollar donations or without corporate PACs. Beto O'Rourke raised $80 million with taking no PAC money. But how likely is it that these candidates running for president who need to raise tens of millions of dollars are going to be able to raise that kind of money without tapping into traditional sources of funding?
That's really the hot question right now. And I think that when I talk to a lot of strategists and campaign consultants, you know, it's interesting because everyone would love to have tens of millions of dollars and not have to raise any of it. That's kind of the dream. And in a way, that's what I mean, that isn't what Sanders did in 2016, but his campaign caught fire and he had tons of people who were giving him lots of money in $27 increments. I think a lot of other campaigns right now, as they're getting going, see being in his position is really a luxury that they can't afford. Mm-hmm. And so for them, it's kind of saying, how much can we get from the small dollar donations and how much do we have to get from everywhere else? So I've kind of used Jay Inslee as one example. You know, a lot of people say, he's kind of one of the candidates who has a super PAC helping him, one of very few at this point. Why does Jay Inslee have a super PAC? Well, a lot of people don't know who Jay Inslee is. He's the governor of Washington. He really needs name ID. He doesn't have a Bernie Sanders army of people who are going to help him out. And so he's someone who has wealthy donors. You know, shortly after he announced, someone did a $1 million ad buy in Iowa that's going to help get Jay Inslee's name out there. And so I think for a lot of people, there's this combination. no one knows the answer, but what you're seeing campaigns do in action, which kind of shows what their theory of the case is really this hybrid. You know, Kamala Harris is a good example. She's someone who's kind of proving to be a powerhouse. She's holding multiple campaign fundraisers every week with a lot of wealthy donors. There are a lot of people who seem to be ready to back her bid. They find her to be really inspiring. And part of the reason that wealthy people find her to be inspiring is because they saw her campaign launch was really packed in Oakland. And they think that she's a really interesting person, you know, and liberals think, oh, Kamala has a lot of grassroots energy. And so, you know, she could really be the nominee. And so they want to line up and support her. But she also is someone who's really working hard to get those small dollar donors up. I think everyone, you know, Democrats are all really jealous of the Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke model right now. But I don't think most people think that they could do a full campaign.
I also want to figure out then, we have all these unwritten rules. So who polices them? Who decides which candidate has gone outside the bounds, so to speak, of the right kind of fundraising? You know, okay, well, you're not taking corporate PAC money, but this person who's the CEO of a big pharmaceutical company is doing a fundraiser for you. Is that going to be policed by the individual candidates, by reporters like you, by outside groups? How's that going to work?
It seems like it's going to be all of the above. I think that you've heard a little bit from the candidates policing each other, because they certainly, you know, if you're going to voluntarily say, I'm not going to do this, you're not going to let someone else off the hook. And it's been a pretty friendly primary so far, but not on this. Like they're kind of willing to nudge each other a little bit on this issue, because I think that it is potent. And it's, you know, and I'm thinking when I say this of Warren in particular, is willing to kind of point out what she's doing, kind of point out what other people are doing. I think that groups sometimes, you know, you have groups like End Citizens United out there. For the most part, there's no real militant. There's no kind of PETA of campaign finance. There's no group that's interested in kind of saying everyone has to do X, Y, and Z. But I think there are groups that are interested in kind of playing in this space. And, you know, it's becoming a space that's going to be self-policing, which means it's going to be wild. Mm. I think the question of, is it fair to have, if you say that you don't take corporate PAC money, is it fair to have all of these individuals from these companies giving your campaigns? I think that ultimately, kind of, if voters start getting angry about that, then candidates are going to have to move on it. And what this is all kind of building towards, by the way, in a sense, is, you know, ultimately one of these people is going to be running against Trump. And I think that it's, Democrats have kind of shown over the last, since he ran for president, you know, kind of a failure to launch really salient lines of attack on him. And I think that there's kind of this implication when you really kind of dig into some of the strategy and the thinking behind this, you know, yes, this is a primary issue and it's a really becoming a key primary issue for people. But also there's thinking, I think, among a lot of Democrats that this is going to be really, really crucial to when it comes to defeating him, is having someone who can have a certain degree of purity about them and be able to really kind of dislodge him and come at him. And, you know, the family connections, the Trump industry, the whole idea that he is a corrupt president, how exactly that anti-Trump message eventually gets honed and defined. It'll depend on the candidate, but I think that that's where a lot of this is going.
Maggie, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
Maggie Severance covers money and politics for Politico.
And that's Amy Walter at our partner, The Takeaway.
When we think about family caregivers for those living with Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia, we often think about people who are actively providing care. But what is life like for those caregivers when their loved one passes away or is placed in a memory care facility? KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie explores the ambiguity of the transitioning caregiver.
You know, I always swore I would never place her as long as possible. I would always keep her at home.
This is only my second visit, so I'm just learning that some of the things I've gone through are similar to what other people are going through.
I'm here because my wife has transitioned now into memory care. It's been a long, long haul.
Those voices belong to caregivers, and on this day, they're attending Banner Alzheimer's Institute's Life Transition Support Group. It's specifically for people who have either placed their loved one in a facility or they've recently lost them. It's a stage that's often riddled with ambiguity. Meet Terry Taylor.
Well, I was a caregiver for my wife. I had to place her in a memory care facility when she ran away at 110 degrees.
So placing her would seem like the most obvious and safest choice. Still,
I had pretty tremendous guilt feelings about that. This last summer, I had to put her on hospice, another guilt trip. As one of the social workers, Susie's counterpart, said, you haven't abandoned your wife, you've accepted reality.
A few weeks after this interview, Taylor's wife passed away. The Susie he's talking about is Susie Favreau. She's a social worker at Banner Alzheimer's Institute.
And then this would happen. Their person would be placed and or the person had died. And more probably when the person had died, there really didn't seem to be an identified role in the ongoing support groups.
Banner has a lot of support groups, and people would go back to those groups even after their person died because
they had been their psychological family, if you will. But over time, they kind of would veer off, or there just didn't seem to be a role for them because they were now kind of entering a new stage of life for them after caregiving.
Life after caregiving. There doesn't seem to be a lot of information about that stage aside from online articles that talk about what you might feel, like relief or grief, resentment or confusion about the future. But the thing is, this stage can last for years, and life is never really the same. Here's Favreau.
This is a huge transition. It's a string of losses. You've been losing that person bit by bit throughout this process, but now this is like the final loss and the reality hitting you that everything now in your life has changed. Your life changed dramatically as a caregiver, so you have some experience with that, and that hopefully is going to be helpful during the transition time of building your life now without that person physically being here.
Dorothy Gallagher was a caregiver. Her husband passed away in October. You heard from her earlier. She was the one who said she's learning that others in this group have had similar experiences to hers. For example?
Just a matter of sometimes the family is not as supportive as you would hope they would be.
This was Gallagher's second marriage. She says her husband's children were not involved in his care.
We don't really know why. And sometimes I think that they would just as soon remember their dad as he was and not how he is right now. I got varying excuses at the time. You know, I can't afford to do it.
Terry Taylor faced a similar situation with his sister-in-law.
The sister told me point blank, don't count on me for anything.
Favreau says family conflict isn't unusual.
Some of the situations are so sad, you know, for the person, the caregiver that's going through that. When they're doing the best they can to give this care to their person, and then to have to be at odds with the family that you hope would be supportive, especially supportive during this situation, but we know that doesn't happen.
Dorothy, do you forgive them?
I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure.
And the people in this group, like Vicki Noble, get how Gallagher feels.
It's nice to know you don't have to explain yourself. Everybody is going through their own version of what you're going through.
In her book, Loving Someone Who Has Dementia, Dr. Pauline Boss talks a lot about what's happening in this room. She calls it ambiguous loss. She writes that it's unclear, it has no resolution, and no closure, even when the person is gone. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For many of us, our lives can revolve around the digital world, our phones, tablets, or social media platforms. But researchers are finding the digital world is also changing how we mourn loved ones who have passed away. Deborah Bassett is a PhD candidate at the University of Warwick in the UK and joins me via Skype to talk more about this. And Deborah, what have you found about how grieving and remembering loved ones has changed in the digital age?
If you think about it, that as a shoebox full of memories, as other researchers have talked about it. And we used to keep memories and messages from our loved ones in the attic, in shoeboxes, in memory boxes. Well, now we carry these things around with us, these memories and messages, on everyday devices. And that is having a real effect. It's the immediacy that people are able to access the dead. And in a way, the dead remain socially alive.
So do we think then that because, you know, we maybe have a photo of a loved one on our smartphone, or we have a voicemail that they left us, like, in our pocket, that is a little more immediate, that they're a little more present with us than, like, having to take the action of going to rifle through a shoebox or, you know, listen to a message on an answering machine that's only in your house, for example?
That's exactly it. That is what happens. So people carry the dead with them. Instead of moving between days when you want to look at things and days when you don't, the dead pop up more often in our social everyday lives. They don't remain dead.
How does that affect the way that we mourn and the way that we move on?
Well, a lot of researchers, me included, would say that we never actually move on, that we learn to live with grief, that we grow around grief. So the digital part of how we grieve still means that we do still grow around that grief. The issue of whether or not it's a comfort or a disruption to grief is linked with who has control of that technology. Have you got access, or are you locked out from platforms? Are you locked out from obsolete digital devices? And that is where the disruption comes from. But for people who have access to these digital memories and messages, they find them a comfort.
Well, it seems like there would be a difference between having a photo or a message or a text or something on your device that somebody had sent to you versus, you know, logging into a loved one's Facebook page or their Twitter or something. I mean, are there privacy issues that come in here as well?
Yes, and I think a lot of my research is looking at the rights of the dead versus the rights of the living. And that is a big issue. You're absolutely right. Privacy does come into this. But I think the thing that I found really interesting at the very beginning, if I go back the 3.5 years when I started this, the thing I found most interesting was the different messages and memories that people really like. And it's, you know, you think about photographs, but you don't think about, well, I certainly didn't at the beginning, about WhatsApp messages. People really love WhatsApp messages and they love keeping them. And when I've sort of asked further with participants if they could explain why they are so precious, they explained to me that it's because of the everydayness of the message. You know, just pop into the shops, do you need anything? I'm ringing your doorbell, things like that. That's what they like about it, that it's not anything deep and meaningful.
Why do you think that is?
I think because people say to me that because they can scroll back through WhatsApp, so they can see the whole sort of, they can see chatting on a good day, they can see chatting when things aren't too good.
One of the other things that I thought was really interesting about your research is that you found people were reluctant to, for example, get a new phone because they were afraid that in the process of putting all the information from their old phone onto their new phone that they would lose something. Or even services that will help you archive things. People were nervous that something would get lost in that process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the biggest finding of the research, and this is a new theory that I'm working on at the moment, this fear of second loss. And it's something that we didn't really have to deal with before. The bereaved didn't have to deal with this. But as much as these messages and memories become the most prized possession, then there's this fear that they will lose them. And even with people who are using third-party software, they feel that if it's then transferred onto something else, that somehow they would lose some of the essence of the person that they had lost, which I found really, really interesting. Somebody explained it to me that it would be like moving house. and then resetting up the bedroom of her deceased daughter in exactly the same way, with the same quilt covers, with the same cushions and posters, it would still feel different. It would lose some of that essence.
That's Deborah Bassett. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Warwick in the UK. Deborah, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So many areas of Arizona lend themselves to our escapes to nature, from the deserts to the mountains, from south to north. And that's part of what makes the Valley such an ideal place for this weekend's performances of Mountain Days, a musical based on the life and writings of naturalist John Muir. Muir was a huge part of the U.S. National Park Service's origins and was a founder of the Sierra Club. And Mountain Days utilizes those key points to illustrate his life in song. Craig Baumler, composer of the piece, and his husband Rusty Farrakhan, who's directing this weekend's shows for ProMusica Arizona, are with me to talk about Mountain Days. So, Craig, first, how did you go about learning as much as you could about John Muir?
I read about 10 books of his letters, of John Muir's letters, and they were amazingly flowery. And then my lyricist and book writer, Mary Bracken Phillips, was able to take many of those letters and lyricize them. So he writes, for example, "Climb the mountains, get their glad tidings. Nature's peace will fill your soul." And then that scans in three, actually. And so we, our big hymn of the piece, which is when he first sees Yosemite, and then which closes out the musical, is "Climb the Mountains."
Mm. Rusty, what makes Muir an interesting character to play? Because we've all heard the name John Muir. We vaguely, at the very least, know how much he was involved in nature. But what kind of character is he to play?
Actually, I hadn't heard of John Muir. I'm embarrassed to admit.
I'm turning off your microphone right now.
Sure. but I was around when Craig was writing that, so I learned about him through that whole process. This is a character who you kind of have to create for the stage, because we don't know what he was really like other than his letters and the historical documents we have. Fortunately, the book writer, who's brilliant, was able to really create this three-dimensional character who's filled with passion and self-doubt and humor and joy, and he's really fun to portray that way. I didn't want to get hung up on the historical background of him. I just wanted to approach him as a human being, to make him a relatable, genuine character for the audience. So that's how I'm approaching it. But he's very fun because he's, like I was saying, he's passionate about nature and about the beauty and about how it makes him feel, and he's passionate about protecting it so everyone can enjoy it. Mm. And being someone who also appreciates nature and loves hiking and loves the outdoors, I can really appreciate the legacy that he's left for now, me and for future generations.
I wondered if the two of you had to sort of relate to that to some extent. Obviously not be quite as passionate as he was, because that was his life's work. But does that help move it along? Does that help inspire the two of you when you're doing the art?
Oh, absolutely. I moved from Houston, Texas, which, though a great city, is not known for its natural beauty. But being spending summers in Colorado for most of my youth with my grandparents at their cabin there, I knew that when I, came onto my own, that I would be moving into a place of great beauty. I actually thought that would be Colorado, but it ended up being Arizona, and that is in some ways grander to me, this desert. And of course, John Muir was responsible for, with Teddy Roosevelt, for the formation of the first three national parks, with the Grand Canyon, Yosemite, and Yellowstone. I think it was Yellowstone may have even been first, if not Yosemite, and then the Grand Canyon. So those three in particular.
Rusty, what's the dramatic arc of this production?
Actually, the whole piece is sort of a flashback of his life. It starts off at the end of his life, right before he dies, and he's just reflecting on his career, his growing up in Scotland and coming to America, and the fight he had to do to get America to save this natural beauty, along with Teddy Roosevelt. And I think that's the arc of it, is the impact that one person can have on something as substantial as saving the environment and nature.
Well, he was obviously a visionary because we're still sort of fighting these battles today.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, yep. If this piece may even be more relevant now than it ever has been.
Yeah.
We are having the fight of climate change, you know, mm-hmm. and climate change isn't just about, you know, the possible destruction of our coastal cities or changing climate patterns, but it could also be the destruction of our natural environment that was put away as our legacy for Americans to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And we know we fight that now even at the Grand Canyon with the uranium mines or possibly with the putting of this funicula down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon on the Navajo Nation. This is a constant fight of how Yosemite is going to be logged and forested so that when they have these giant forest fires, everything isn't destroyed. Mm-hmm. And they still don't really have that one down. And so we fight this. But fortunately, we have the Sierra Club and we have John Muir's legacy. And those who know about him hopefully will get on board and become as passionate as we did when we learned about him.
Rusty, what's it like to be collaborating on this show with your husband and someone that was so involved in the creation of it? Are you allowed to direct in the way you want to, or do you have to consult?
Yeah. No. Craig is wonderful to work with.
You guys collaborate well on this?
Okay. We do.
Okay.
You know, I didn't have to collaborate much with him. Since he's the composer, his job was done, and he's just sitting back letting us take over. Patty Grates, who's the artistic director of Pro Musica, is handling the orchestra and the choir. This is a concert version of the musical, so I don't have the overwhelming task of a full-on production where there's sets and costumes and lights and sound. So basically, I'm just moving people around microphones. My job is a little easier in that sense.
Okay.
But I haven't had to collaborate with him, but I've certainly done that for years. We work very well together.
Right. Rusty has done many of my shows. He's done many of my workshops. He's directed them. He's starred in them. He's everything. I mean, it's great to have him because I will get a top acting and singing experience from him. And since I write musicals, that's really a great privilege.
Craig Baumler is the composer of Mountain Days, and Rusty Farrakhan is the director and star. There will be three performances this weekend. The first is tonight at the Rogers Amphitheater at Murphy Park in Glendale. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I think if I had told my dad, 7 months after you're dead, you're going to be dominating the news and all over Twitter, he would think it was hilarious that our president was so jealous of him mm-hmm. that he was dominating the news cycle in death as well.
The subpoena requires Mr. Stringer to go ahead and supply us with documents by Wednesday, and also furthermore, submit to an interview with the attorneys that have been hired by the State House on Friday.
At this moment, there is something undeniably special happening in Phoenix. Because of the investments we've made, the job market is shifting. Wages are rising as knowledge-based sectors grow.
With us to talk about the new mayor of Phoenix, some of the latest legislative news and more are Marcus Dellartino, partner at First Strategic, and David Lujan, director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Always great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Marcus, how exciting is the new mayor of Phoenix going to be, Kate Gallego? Is she going to make a difference in the city?
Well, you know, any change in the mayor's office is going to be exciting, right? And so now this is her opportunity to sort of put her path forward for Phoenix. And I think that that's going to be chock block full of, you know, new initiatives, new ideas. There's no doubt about that. The thing that is always difficult about the city of Phoenix is remembering it's a city manager form of government, meaning the city council controls who the city manager is, but at the end of the day, the city manager is really pulling the plug. So elected officials, mayors, and city council people have to, you know, take these big visions or big initiatives and big ideas and sort of get help or buy-in, if you will, from the cities to execute. And that's always really the toughest challenge. But, you know, she's a smart cookie, and I think that she'll be able to build her coalitions and be able to do some of these initiatives and moving forward.
David, is she going to be a forceful leader and someone who really has a vision and an agenda?
I think she will. I think, when she got into this race, a lot of people were discounting her chances. They, you know, Danny Valenzuela had all the union backing and the key endorsements. And I think what Kate proved is that she is a formidable candidate. She can raise money and she, you know, she can really go out there. And I think that's the kind of mayor she's going to be. She's smart. She works incredibly hard. And, you know, I think her challenge, she's going to have to run again in 2 years. So, and the council's got a lot of division and turmoil. And so, you know, how do you get some accomplishments in that kind of a environment? And so I'm hoping that what she'll do is, you know, pick an idea or two that really she can get onto. I think affordable housing is one. You know, that's a big issue right now in Phoenix and one that, you know, impacts people across economic lines. And so, you know, I think that's an example of something that she can really, if she can show some leadership and get some things done, you know, she's going to be, a very formidable mayor for years to come.
David, do you anticipate that the types of policy issues she takes on and her leadership style will be noticeably different than her predecessor? I mean, the most recent elected predecessor, Greg Stanton?
I think it'll be similar, but you know, I think you know, Kate will build some more of those coalitions, and she's just, I think she's very pragmatic as well, and so I think it'll be similar, but you know, maybe a little bit different.
Marcus, what do you think?
I agree. She'll be somewhat similar. You know, Mayor Stanton was a Democrat, obviously, and somewhat from the progressive side of the aisle. She shares that in common with him. I think that to that end, I think that they'll have sort of similar ideas. You know, I always, being a dad of young kids, I will say this, she's a mother of a young one, and your multitasking skills develop exponentially overnight. And so that is a real strength, I think, that she'll have going into being mayor.
Marcus, what kind of future does she have? Let's already jump on that train, because we've talked often on this show and other programs as well that the Democrats for a long time didn't seem to have a bench. Maybe that's changing in Arizona. It seemed to based on last November. Is she someone who is an up-and-coming star? How closely are you watching that?
You know, it certainly needs to be watched, but it's going to get somewhat confusing here shortly, I think, because remember, Ruben Gallego who is looking to run for the Senate in 2 years. So you could have two Gallegos in the city of Phoenix on a ballot. And so in the short term, I think people are going to focus on Ruben Gallego running for the U.S. Senate in a primary against Mark Kelly is how that would shape up. And you know, frankly, I think that announcement's going to come sort of quickly and shortly. And so that'll be the short-term look. And then long-term look, okay, what's that mean for her future? What happens to him in that race? Is he able to pull it off? Is he the next U.S. senator? Or does he lose? And what's his future and how does that fit into where she is in city of Phoenix?
Yeah, I mean, I think her toughest election was this last one. I mean, she's there and I think, you know, yes, she has to run again in 2 years. But I think, you know, if she does everything right, I think she could be there for many years to come. But, Steve, I think you hit it exactly on the head in terms of 4 years ago, everybody was talking about how the Democrats didn't have much of a bench in Arizona. I think that has changed for sure. I think Democrats' bench is deep and strong now, and Kate is part of that. She's, like I said, she's smart. She works hard. She's proven that she can raise money. And we've got a lot of Democratic candidates that have shown that they can fundraise, they can win statewide, they can appeal to voters statewide. And so, you know, it's... That's a good thing for Democrats is that our bench is deepening. And I think for Kate, she's certainly one of those people that's going to have an opportunity in the future for whatever she wants to do.
Marcus, David mentioned affordable housing as a potential issue for now Mayor Gallego to take on. Any that you expect her to really be focusing on in the next short term here?
Well, short term's light rail. Definitely, because the voters are looking at an initiative that makes some drastic changes to how light rails, does it continue in the city of Phoenix or not is essentially the question. And so I think short term, that's going to be her major focus. And some of those members on the city council that she's able to build a coalition, I know they're engaging with some of the groups right now, whether it's contractors or those folks that have a vested interest in continuing light rail. And I think that right now, today, that's going to be the number one goal. I do agree with David, though, on affordable housing. And to that end, you know, we've got to have a discussion about these giblets, these government leased excise tax, where essentially at the end of the day, the government, who does not pay taxes, owns the ground of the building. And the owner then leases that back from the city. It's been a long time practice, but it does need significant reform for everybody's sake, but especially the taxpayers.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, Giplets, I think, you know, and that impacts schools too. I mean, it impacts their ability to raise money, to go out and do bonds and overrides. And you know, that's been a big issue at the city level. And I think that's another one that Kate could really, you know, grasp. And if she can do something about that, you know, I think a lot of people would be cheering her on.
Now, David, to the other Gallego that Marcus referred to.
Yeah.
Any doubt that Ruben Gallego runs for Senate?
I have very little doubt. From what I'm hearing, I think he's going in, and I think it will be in the near future, very near future.
And how many people do you expect to run for that House seat, and will you be one of them?
I will not be one of them. I expect quite a few are going to jump in. Names that I've heard, obviously Laura Pastor, I think, will be one, which then will create more, you know, interesting things on the city council. But I think, Reggie Boulding in the state legislature, Raquel Turan, Fontes, our Maricopa County recorder. So, again, it's part of that deep bench. But I think Ruben's going to run.
And do you see any generational issues there? In terms of last time we saw Mary Rose Wilcox against mm-hmm. Ruben Gallego, and there was a real divide there. Do you feel like we're just going to see sort of young and up-and-comers, folks you mentioned like that?
I'm trying to think of who might be sort of the older generational candidate that's out there. None that I've heard that. Actually, Phil Gordon. I've heard that name out there. So, that could be interesting. I think it's going to be some interesting times.
I'd just add Steve Gallardo over at Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, another one. Just to give you a concept of how many people are looking to run for the seat, it's going to be a wild, wild west shootout, if you will. And also, back to the original story on the city of Phoenix, there's going through a lot of change over there mm-hmm. at the city of Phoenix on that council. And so there's certainly a lot of new blood, but with that comes a learning curve.
It would be a shame if we had to go a few months without an election to fill some position within the city of Phoenix, right?
Well, and then, you're not kidding. And then look at all the elections that could take place you've got Laura Pastor, so that would have to be filled. You've got Reggie Boulding, that seat would have to be filled. Steve Gallardo, that seat would have to be filled. So the dominoes effect starts to take
but
place.
I will say, too, that this also happened when Congressman Pastor stepped down from the seat a few years ago. There was a whole bunch of names early on, and then it kind of filtered out, and we ended up, having, two candidates. So sometimes that happens. I think people will talk about it, but, it might get narrowed down quite a bit when it actually comes to it.
David, how do you see a Ruben Gallego-Mark Kelly Senate primary shaping up?
I think it's going to be fierce. Ruben's a strong candidate in himself. He's a veteran, a Marine, and Harvard graduate. So they both come with this with really strong credentials. I think when it comes to Ruben, I think what people are going to be looking at, what Democrats in particular are going to be looking at, is can he defeat Martha McSally in a general election? I think I think Ruben's going to do very well in his district, in his area, Maricopa County. But I think to come out of the primary, I think he's going to have to answer in Democrats' minds that he can be able to beat Martha McSally in a general election. I think that's where a lot of Democrats aren't sure. I think more people think that Mark Kelly will be the stronger general candidates.
Yeah, I think you're looking at classic case of the more progressive candidate versus the center of mm-hmm. the Democrat Party. And that's how today that's going to roll out. Ruben is clearly a bomb thrower, is always comfortable in that role. I think this campaign will have a lot of media attention around it just from that standpoint.
Before we go to break, though, have you guys comment on this whole bomb throwing thing? Because is there a hesitation? I mean, speculation that one of the reasons, probably a long list, that Grant Woods decided not to run is he didn't really want to attack Mark Kelly because of Gabby Giffords or related things to that. Marcus, do you see Gallego holding back at all because of that?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean,
I've
known Ruben for a number of years. I've worked with him. Obviously, we're from two different parties, but that doesn't mean we're not able to work on issues together. But I don't see any hesitation. He is the Marine Corps did a very good job training that soldier. He is not afraid to go into a firefight, I will tell you that.
Yeah, I agree. I think Ruben, when he campaigns, it's no holds barred, and that's, I think, what you're going to see in this case.
That's David Lujan. Also here is Marcus Dellartino with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We are in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. This is the Friday Newscap on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our panelists today are David Lujan, director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress, and Marcus Dellartino, partner at First Strategic.
All right, guys, so let's talk about something at the state capitol this week. The House Ethics Committee had a meeting and basically said to one of their colleagues, Representative David Stringer, that we want you to turn over some documents. We want you to submit to an interview by the investigators. Marcus, it seems as though there's some dispute over whether that the documents that the committee wants are allowed to be turned over. Where do you see this whole situation at right now?
What's amazing is, like, you didn't think you could get any more drama out of this story, and then we figured out a way to create more drama. And what happened yesterday is the state Supreme Court ruled that those documents actually cannot be made public. And you know, from a purely legal standpoint, they have a very valid point. You've just said to a judge that sealing a document has absolutely no meaning whatsoever, and you can expect the judge is not the bench is not going to put up with that very well, right? So I think that the committee is somewhat stuck in an odd situation, and I think that the only solution to either to get these documents is to sign a deal with Mr. Stringer that says those will remain private and sort of as part of the investigation, which, by the way, there is precedent in another ethics investigation that those documents did remain private. And so right now I think that's the only solution. But I am a big proponent that the best way to handle this, by the way, is – either through a recall election or giving the choice back to the voters in some way, shape, or form. That the proper forum for this debate actually belongs with the voters and not down here at the legislature.
David, do you see what happened this week affecting his ability to stay in the House before his next election?
I do. I think the best thing that could happen is that he will resign. I don't think he will. I think he should have resigned after the racist comments that he made. And but yes, I think it behooves him to actually have more information out there about what happened. You know, he is an elected official that we should know what happened if what's been alleged. And so I think what's going to happen is I think ultimately the committee is going to move forward to remove him from the legislature. I think that's what should happen if he doesn't resign. And, we'll see what happens.
Marcus, and either the – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to add to that. What adds to this drama, if you will, is that if everybody remembers that these allegations – part of these are the comments. Mm-hmm. But the other part of this was a court case that happened, I think, 20 years ago or at some
or
point
more.
A very long time ago.
80s, yeah.
But we are opening up the door then for these precedents to exist where we start looking at all 90 legislators and, frankly, probably the 90 legislators at least, to go up in front of an ethics committee for something that occurred, not as part of their duties as a representative or a senator, number one, but number two, long before they were ever elected to office, to put those up for investigation and then have the body vote on whether they should expel them. I just throw that out there as part of that this saga will continue to go on regardless of what happens to Mr. Stringer.
David, do you think it has legs in that sense?
I think Marx has a point. And I think, for me, I still go back to just the racist comments. I think those alone, are reason why he should be removed from office. And I don't even think they need to get into the charges that happened 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, I think it's going to be up to the committee and to the full the full House at some point. The other issue is, and I think unfortunately, I hope this doesn't get into their thinking, but we have a 31-29 legislative split. We're coming up into that time where it's budget season and key votes, and so I think that I hope does not come into the thinking of someone in the majority that we can't afford to lose that 31 vote.
Marcus, that leads into the question I wanted to ask you, which is that from a practical level or from a political level, has this affected daily doings in the House, the fact that the Stringer thing is still hanging over the body?
I don't think, I don't think it has affected the daily doings as it pertains directly to Mr. Stringer. The daily doings are dependent upon if all the members are there or not, right? And to that end, there's been a couple of members who haven't been there that were not Mr. Stringer. Mr. Yeah. Stringer actually has been on the floor. And so to that end, I don't think it will. But there is some, you know, cognizant thought put into, okay, let's just say we did expel him. How much time do we have to make the appointment of a new legislator to fill that seat? Is that 2 weeks or 2 days? I will tell you, in this particular case, I expect it would, if the body votes to expel him, the body would move very quickly to fill that seat. Yeah. There is a procedure that is in statute that needs to be filled, and it can move relatively quickly. I don't think it will hold up the process as much as people may fear.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are already people out there lining up potential appointments, you know, people to fill his seat. So,
well, I mean, is this something that you guys think the county supervisors are at least maybe informally thinking about or talking about? Like, because the city council in Prescott said you should resign. I mean, is this something they have some folks in mind already just in case he does step down?
Well, it's actually a little bit more complicated, but the answer, your short answer is yes. But it rests with a body called the precinct committeeman, and both parties, Democrats and Republicans, have that office called the precinct committeeman. Those people will meet and recommend three names. The board of supervisors then will pick from one of those three names. And absolutely, that conversation is happening and that debate is happening. I've been through, you know, about 10 of these when I worked for the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. And, yeah, you want to be prepared for what's coming your way, and you want to be professional about it. And so to that end, I think that they're making sure their ducks are – if the body makes that choice, that they are efficient and make a good choice.
Yeah, I have no information on what's happening, but I just know how these things work, and I'm sure that there are Republicans in Yavapai County who are aiming for that appointment, and so they are already, you know, talking to people, talking to supervisors and PC precinct committeemen, and, you know, jockeying for that appointment.
So, Marcus, let's talk about your former boss, the late Senator John McCain. Somehow he is still dominating the news cycle because President Trump can just not get enough of him. What is going on there? Is this some obsession?
You know, Meghan McCain, God love her, stole my line the last couple days. But I immediately, when I saw that, my first reaction was, God, John is laughing his rear end off up in heaven right now that he's still dominating the news cycle months later. And it's true. I truly believe that. And it's a very odd dynamic that's going on. I don't think it behooves the president. I don't think he gets him any votes to talk about it. And frankly, to some extent, the exact opposite. But for some reason, he can't let go. But when you look at his pattern, I think that there's a number of those items that when you look at, he can't let go of some certain things. What is somewhat entertaining is then also watching, and I don't know if most people know this, but I find it fascinating, is Kellyanne Conway has been one of his top advisors for ever since he got elected, and her husband —
that is a fascinating —
is beating the tar out of the President of the United States on a daily basis on Twitter. And I just can't help to think what dinner is like at home.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, David, one quick political thing on this. There's been some criticism lodged against Senators McSally and Sinema recently about how they've handled President Trump's comments. What do you make of that? I mean, we know the boat that McSally finds herself in, trying to sort of play both sides. Should Senator Sinema be more outspoken against President Trump? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think Senator Sinema did issue a statement condoning President Trump's comments.
Not condoning, but
yeah,
condemning.
Condemning. Kirsten had made some comments about not trying to feed into all of the president's Twitters and trying to, you know, just basically ignoring. And that's the thing we should be doing. And I agree with that. But, you know, Senator McCain is an Arizona hero. He's a you know, obviously an icon in our state. So I would kind of actually like to see both of them speak out a little bit more on this particular issue. I totally get we should be ignoring the president's tweets because he's just trying to get attention. And, you know, decent human beings do not go after somebody when they've passed away, particularly somebody who's a war hero. And so it's just despicable.
Marcus, any more comments on that?
Oh, I do. I enjoyed Kirsten's comments, and I think I'm a valid believer in her strategy. And I know she was a little frustrated with EJ Montini from the Republic for sort of pushing this button. But her point is valid. We're creating our own news cycle when we repeat these stories or re-respond to them. So I think we've got to start to look at that as sort of a new and evolving strategy.
David, let's wrap up with a few seconds on your beloved Sun Devils. The ASU men's team plays today at 12:50.
Yes.
Speaking with your head and not your heart, do you think they're going to win against Buffalo today?
I think that ASU today is going to do what the U of A could not do last year, and that is beat Buffalo in the first round.
That was impressive. He got a prediction and a dig at U of A at the same time.
Well played. I expect this. I think ASU will make the first round, but that'll be sort of the end of it. And this is a guy who continually bet on U of A to go three rounds and was disappointed every single year. So from that standpoint, I'm saying don't get too heavily vested. But everybody should have fun watching this and play their pool.
That is Marcus Dellartino, partner for Strategic. David Lujan is director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew O. Jackson didn't want his new book, The Human Network, How Your Social Position Determines Your Power, Beliefs, and Behaviors, to be confused with The Social Network or Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. He argues all human types of human interactions happen in networks, whether they're online or in person, and those human networks affect us in ways large and small. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke more about it with Jackson via Skype.
So most of our information is something that we essentially get through friends or discuss with friends, and they have a huge impact on our opinions. There's lots of peer influence. Our opportunities, job opportunities, other kinds of things happen through acquaintances and friends. So these things are always going on, and we're aware of it, but I don't think we're aware of the extent of it and also the kinds of biases that it introduces into our behaviors.
So you're saying that we are influenced by the people around us in ways that we don't even realize.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Give us an example.
Well, one example is that we often, when we think about norms of behavior, we often look to our friends and look at the people around us and project that onto the society. And there's sort of two ways in which those friends are special. One is that we tend to interact with people who are very similar to ourselves, so they're different from the rest of the society. And the other is that they're not a random sample, even from people that are similar to ourselves. And the idea there is what's known as the friendship paradox, which refers to the fact that our friends tend to be more popular than we are. They tend to be the most popular people in the society, and that's just a counting exercise. If somebody has 20 friends and somebody else has 2 friends, the person with 20 friends is going to be seen as a friend by a lot more people. And
sure.
That means that, you know, our composition of friend groups are overrepresented by really popular people.
But that, you're saying, skews the view that we get of the world.
Exactly. And when you add in social media, where this becomes extreme, then there's people who have many times more friends than other people. Those people tend to dominate the observations we have and the way that we view the world.
Hmm. So, I mean, most of us know, right, like from high school, what kind of social scheme we fit into if we're, you know, cool or popular or brainy or nerdy or whatever it may be. You're also talking about hidden positions here, though. What does that mean?
Well, I think part of it is that we are aware that there are these sort of cliques. But the extent to which that is true and the extent to which there's sort of a lack of connections across groups is pretty striking. And there can be very few people who are actually connecting across groups. So, you know, one study we did looking at one high school, for instance, a little more than half white and about 40% black, and then a mixture of Hispanic and other. The kids were 15 times more likely to be friends with people of their own race than other races. And so the sheer extent of this is pretty overwhelming. And it means that very different norms can exist in different parts of the society, and very different information can be flowing to these different groups. And that feeds into why one group might be sending a lot of kids to college and another group might not be. You know, we don't see our networks. It's sort of hidden in the sense that these aren't things that are completely self-evident to us.
So the implications of this then can be very broad. Is that why you want people to think more consciously about the human network that they're a part of?
Yeah, I mean, for two reasons. One is just as individuals, we can counteract some of the effects that limit the information we have and bias our opinions. And the other is that if we're a government thinking about how to increase the set of people who go on to get college degrees and improve employment among disadvantaged groups, things like that, this gives us a very different lens into what kinds of policies we need, because, you know, we need to combat the sort of smaller echo chambers and the limits that those put on people's access to information and opportunities.
So your background is in economics, right? And so there's definitely an economic, a financial component to what you're looking at here. This seems like something initially that is like an anthropology thing or sociology, right? So how does this financial economic side fit in?
Sure. I guess the same kinds of patterns apply not just to people, but to companies. So companies are interacting with each other and they are partnering and doing different kinds of joint ventures and sometimes exposed to each other's risks. And understanding how contagion works in a human network in terms of just individual people helps us understand how it works in financial networks.
Yeah. So you've said in the past that economists just used to assume that everybody had access to everything, right? Are you arguing against in this book this very American idea that we can all pull ourselves up from our bootstraps then, like that anybody can achieve anything?
Well, I think the American dream is something that we all aspire to and hope that it exists. But when you look at the numbers, there's a lot of social context that really is limiting and constraining. And I think being aware of that is something that's important. And the more that we understand how it affects people and how we can counteract it, the better off we'll be.
So are there people who can counteract this, who have successfully done that just by being aware of it and by, you know, actively reaching outside of their existing network?
Sure. Actually, there's a lot of research that tries to look at where creativity comes from and where the most innovative people are. And often they sit in positions where they connect different groups, where, you know, they're actually talking to more than one group. And, you know, it's difficult to put yourself out there and to put yourself in uncomfortable situations and be the only person from one group, you know, talking to another. But it also really changes the way that people think, and it can really be enlightening.
All right. Matthew O. Jackson is the author of the new book, The Human Network: How Your Social Position Determines Your Power, Beliefs, and Behaviors. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Lauren.
Under a new California law that took effect on New Year's Day, the state's labor commissioner has published a list of trucking companies that have either not paid their drivers or against whom judgments have been issued over wage issues. But the law, known as SB 1402, goes farther and makes retailers co-liable if they work with a trucking company on the list. Shane Gussman is legislative director for the California Teamsters Public Affairs Council.
It gives retailers a choice and some transparency on who they're doing business with. They can see if a company's on the list, and they know what it means, and they can choose whether or not they want to roll the dice and continue or start doing business with someone on the list.
Gussman argues drivers are often misclassified as independent contractors, and he says even when wage claims against trucking companies are upheld, they still don't pay the drivers. But critics of the new law worry about its impact on smaller trucking firms. Joe Rakovat, director for governmental affairs for the Western States Trucking Association, calls many of the judgments themselves ridiculous.
While larger shippers are going to be very savvy and their legal departments are going to make sure that they're off those lists, the same isn't true for the majority of shippers where they themselves are small businesses. Really, frankly, and in our opinion, a lot of these businesses aren't even aware that they have this liability right now.
Make no mistake, these companies know exactly what's going on.
That's Shane Gussman with the California Teamsters Public Affairs Council again.
They've engaged in this bad behavior to cheat the system, and they make money off of it, and they've been caught. So it shouldn't come as a surprise for these companies that this is going on, and we shouldn't advantage people who break the law with our business.
Gusman says since the law only took effect a couple of months ago, he hasn't heard any anecdotal evidence yet of what kind of impact it's having. But Joe Rakovats with the Western States Trucking Association says he's aware of some attorneys advising their clients to minimize their legal risk by only working with bigger shippers. He considers that to be unfair competition in the trucking industry and worries the practice will spread to other states.
There are things that tend to occur in California. And this, what we view is this constant fight against having independent contractors, owner-operators, in the case of trucking, in the marketplace. California has been ground zero, but it has already spread.
In a statement, California's labor commissioner says the new law, quote, incentivizes trucking companies to pay up on judgments and put earned wages into drivers' pockets. We have all done it, driving in circles over and over to find the perfect parking spot. Sometimes it seems like there aren't enough spaces to go around, but when we recently spoke with Christopher Haney, he's a graduate researcher in ASU's engineering program, he had news for us. Turns out a full 10% of the city of Phoenix is parking lots. Here's Haney.
There have been a number of studies that have quantified parking across cities, and a lot of the times just look at total pavement coverage, so not just parking, but also sidewalks and roads. And actually, I think many people would be surprised to hear that sometimes it can be as high as like 40 to 60%. In some cases, you look at San Francisco, they don't even have enough parking. So it can be an issue that goes both ways even.
Haney added up all of the many, many parking spots inside Phoenix, which was no small feat. He's actually the first here to comprehensively tally these spaces. He derived the numbers from estimates of city code, but it's not an exact science here.
So the space is, you know, 9 by 18 feet, and then there's the space you need to access a parking space. Based on the property type, you know, if it's a church, if it's a conference center, if it's just a single family home, it requires so much space based on usually the square footage.
All right, so now maybe you're wondering, why on earth is this man counting parking spaces? Well, Haney says cities haven't done a good job of planning their parking beyond the worst case scenario. That's why he says the big box store has enough spaces for a massive Black Friday crowd, even though that only happens once a year.
A lot of the times when you go on an off-peak day, like I was just at Costco yesterday, there's nobody there. You know, the parking lot's one-third full. How to fix it? Well, first, cities need to quantify how much parking they have. So without knowing how much supply they have, and sometimes not also knowing the demand, there's really, it's sort of like we're flying blind.
He says it's time for cities to stop ignoring the massive amount of hardscape they add with every new building. But what about the other side of this coin? In the ever-expanding valley that is extremely car-centric, is more parking really a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's an argument that we should always be having. I mean, I think there are trade-offs that we need to be cognizant of. We all want Phoenix to grow, but I think from our perspective, you know, researching sort of sustainable ways to accomplish this growth, building more parking may not be the answer, and I think we're trying to start to argue that that's not going to be the answer.
Haney's research appears in the journal Cities. You can read it if you'd like to park yourself in front of it.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.